Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the decision of black and white Americans to ride side by side on trailways and Greyhound buses change the course of American history? 50 years ago this spring, the Congress of Racial Equality organized a group of passengers who refused to segregate according to race on interstate bus routes. The Supreme Court had declared such segregation illegal more than a decade earlier, but that ruling was routinely ignored in the Jim Crow South. Raymond Arsenault is John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida at St. Petersburg. He tells the story of what those brave passengers endured in his book Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. The book is out now in trade paperback as a companion edition to the American Experience documentary based on Arsenault's work that will debut on KERA Channel 13 television May 16th. Ray, welcome to Think.
Thank you. My pleasure.
A lot of people, I think, don't realize that, in fact, the Freedom Rides were not the first individual cases where people tried to mount an organized campaign to end transportation segregation. Can you talk about the first salvo fired in 1946?
Yes. The original Freedom Ride was known as the Journey of Reconciliation, and it was also organized by the Congress of Racial Equality. It was the brainchild of Bayard Rustin, famous Gandhian sage who later was largely responsible for the 1963 March on Washington and was a major advisor to Dr. Martin Luther King. And it followed the Morgan versus Virginia Supreme Court decision of June of 1946, which declared that it was illegal to require segregation for interstate passengers on buses. Irene Morgan was a young woman from Baltimore who had been arrested in Gloucester County, Virginia in 1944, and she took her case all the way to the Supreme Court. And Thurgood Marshall, in one of his first great efforts, was able to win a victory in the court in 1946. And it became immediately apparent that the attorneys general and Southern politicians were inclined just to ignore it. They kind of a bait-and-switch almost tactic in the sense that they said, "Well, it's up to the bus companies, and the bus companies are doing it. It really isn't a function of state law." And it became almost impossible for the NAACP to get the decision to have some real meaning. So that's when the Congress of Racial Equality stepped in, essentially a northern organization that was affiliated with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, a group of kind of radical pacifists and Gandhians. To some degree at that point on the fringe of the civil rights movement, who decided to turn to nonviolent direct action to take the struggle out of the courtroom and into the streets. And so they got 16 volunteers, 8 blacks and 8 whites, to have a test, this Journey of Reconciliation, testing the compliance with the Morgan decision. And they sent these 16 volunteers on buses and trains through the Upper South. Really wasn't possible for them to tackle the Deep South at that point, but they went through Virginia, North Carolina, Kentucky, and Tennessee. There were a number of arrests, and they actually didn't get very much attention, and they didn't get much support even from the NAACP. It was considered to be a kind of a novel tactic, and that very week was the week that when they left Washington in April of 1947 was the very week that Jackie Robinson desegregated Major League Baseball with the Brooklyn Dodgers. So all the attention was on Jackie Robinson, and the Journey of Reconciliation was largely ignored. But it was a very brave effort, and they thought it would be the first of many Freedom Rides, but the Cold War intervened, and most of the core activists had to go essentially underground for the next few years because it was that kind of dissent was associated with kind of communist subversion, and they were very vulnerable and couldn't mount any additional Freedom Rides until 1961.
And what made them in 1961 decide that it was time to try this again?
It had a lot to do with the election of John Kennedy in November of 1960. There was a sense that even though Kennedy didn't have a particularly strong record on civil rights, that there was a clear contrast with President Dwight David Eisenhower, who had been a great disappointment. And John Kennedy talked about a new frontier, and most of what he talked about, of course, was spreading freedom to the third world, to Asia and Africa and Latin America, and he studiously avoided any kind of ambitious domestic program, but the civil rights community was hopeful that he was young and he had ideas and that he could learn. But the first 3 months of his administration were very disappointing for them. Of course, there was the Bay of Pigs fiasco, and which focused his attention even more on the Cold War, and so he seemed to have no time for the civil rights movement. So that essentially forced them to take some desperate tactics to return to the strategy of the Journey of Reconciliation 14 years before, and thinking that they would not let the nation go on with business as usual until they paid attention to civil rights, trying to put it on page one. So they decided to organize something that they called a freedom ride this time, with a more bold kind of notion of asking for freedom now, not later.
How were volunteers recruited for that freedom ride in 1961?
Well, several of the volunteers were actually field secretaries who were on the staff of Corps, and virtually all of them had some experience. In some respects, it was a coming together of the student movement, what was left of the student movement of the 1930s. They were no longer students, of course, but people who had been active in the Congress of Racial Equality or other groups back in the early 1940s and had come out of the labor movement or other movements which had responded to the Great Depression and largely to economic problems, but also to racial problems, and young kids who had been involved in the sit-ins of 1960, people from Atlanta, from Nashville, like Congressman John Lewis. So, of course, many years later, he became a congressman. Mm-hmm. He was just a young student at American Baptist Theological Seminary in Nashville in those days. But they were young, most of them, but they were already veterans. Most of them had been arrested several times in various sit-ins. But they were a mixture of North and South, black and white, male and female, and a number of them actually didn't have any real experience in the Deep South. Again, Corps at that point was still a predominantly Northern organization, and they did mix Southerners and Northerners on the original Freedom Ride, but they didn't have a lot of experience. And even though they sent a scout down to arrange for places for them to stay at various stops and tried to get local sponsors, they really didn't know a great deal about what they were getting themselves into.
They were committed to achieving this without any acts of violence perpetrated by themselves. Can you talk about the sort of training that riders had before they boarded those buses in 1961?
Well, all of the Freedom Riders, the 13 of them, 7 blacks and 6 whites, gathered in Washington for about 3.5 days of intensive training. They had what they called sociodramas, but nonviolent workshops where they would do role-playing and they would abuse each other and use racial epithets and do everything to try to provoke each other to see if they could take it. And all but one of the Freedom Riders was able to maintain their commitment to nonviolence. There was one of them who just got a little bit unnerved and had to drop out, and his roommate took his place. But they spent a very intense 3.5 days at Fellowship House, which was associated with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which was a pacifist group which had spawned the Congress of Racial Equality in 1942, but went back to the World War I period. But they had lectures from sociologists about what to expect in the Deep South, and they had lawyers talk to them about what to do if they were arrested, and it was very, very carefully laid out for them that they had to be disciplined, that they what they were to wear, what they were to bring with them, how they were to interact with the other passengers, and of course they had pamphlets that Corps had provided about the philosophy of nonviolence, and they were very, very well prepared.
How much of this got out before the rides began? Was there a big media push to begin with? Were they sending out press releases, or did they sort of keep it quiet and wait to see what would happen?
No, they were deliberately open about it. The whole point was to see if blacks and whites could sit next to each other, and they could go into a terminal and order a cup of coffee or a hamburger and sit next to each other, and whether they were in the designated black section or white section, and so they wanted the police to know they were coming. They informed, of course, Greyhound and Trailways knew. They informed the FBI. They informed the Kennedy administration. They informed the local police departments. They wanted it to be public because they wanted to see if under normal circumstances that a person could exercise their constitutional rights. So they didn't want it to be covert or surreptitious in any way. And, of course, they knew by letting the police departments know and politicians know that it would probably get to groups like the Ku Klux Klan, mm-hmm. which, of course, it did. So even though there was not a lot of splashy media coverage, they had two black journalists with them and a white magazine writer, a young woman, Charlotte DeVries, who was going to write a story on the Freedom Ride. But there was no national press, and there was not a lot of attention, even though they tried to get people's attention before they left. That was also the week that Alan Shepard made his first space flight. So the world's attention was on Alan Shepard and the competition with the Russians and to put a man in space. And so there was the Freedom Ride did not get much media attention during the first week. But they wanted this to be open. They wanted it to be as normal as possible. These weren't specially chartered buses. They were regular buses, and there were other passengers on them, and they wanted to interact with those passengers. So it was a kind of educated process. They had mass meetings in mostly in black churches along the way, and to talk about the philosophy of nonviolence. They wanted to encourage the local movements in the South to strike blows against Jim Crow, not just on the buses, but in a generalized sense.
You mentioned that they informed the Kennedy administration, and the president was not at all supportive of the idea.
Well, they met with his brother Robert Kennedy at the Justice Department before they left, and Simeon Booker, who was a black journalist who was with them, met with Robert Kennedy. But Robert Kennedy later had no memory of it. He claimed that he hadn't met with him. That Booker even quoted him as saying, "Good luck on your ride. I'd love to go with you," but he later argue that he was that he was surprised by the Freedom Ride, that he didn't know anything about it. So it's there's a kind of a conflict there in terms of the memories of what actually happened. But as far as we know, John Kennedy didn't know anything about it before, but he certainly found out soon enough. And it was from the Kennedy brothers' perspective, of course, the Freedom Ride was a great diversion. Wasn't that they were opposed to civil rights, but it was very low on their priority list. They were essentially, at that point, cold warriors who were worried about Cuba and Berlin and the Soviet Union and the missile gap. And they said they would get to civil rights in time, but they were asking the civil rights activists to be patient. And it was a very frustrating thing for the civil rights community. They had high hopes for the Kennedys, but in John Kennedy's inaugural address, where he talked about the new frontier, he talked about spreading freedom all over the world, everywhere but Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia, and Texas, and Florida. And they snubbed Dr. King. He was not invited to the inauguration. And so they were really keeping the movement leaders at arm's length.
Raymond Arsenault is my guest. He's John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida at St. Petersburg. His book is called Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. It will be made into an American Experience documentary that will air on KERA Channel 13 in May. That's May 16th. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Raymond Arsenault. He's John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida at St. Petersburg and author of the book Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. It's out now in trade paperback. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So the route was planned to be from Washington, D.C. to New Orleans. Is that right?
That's right. A two-week trip. They hoped to get to New Orleans on May 17th, which was the seventh anniversary of the Brown decision, and have a big celebration there in honor of the Brown decision. So it was a two-week trip.
And why take both bus lines, Trailways and Greyhound?
Well, they wanted it, of course, again, to... I think, to represent what ordinary citizens would encounter. Mm-hmm. And they were both important bus lines, and they didn't want to desegregate one bus line and not the other. I think they also wanted to maximize the impact. So by splitting up the Freedom Riders onto the two buses, it just increased the likelihood that this would create some attention and would have some real impact.
So things in the Upper South were not incredibly bad, but then everything changed when they got to Alabama.
That's right. The first arrest was in Charlotte, North Carolina, when one of the Freedom Riders, Black Freedom Riders, tried to get a shoe shine, and he was arrested for disturbing the peace and spent two nights in jail. And then the first violence was in Rock Hill, South Carolina, where three of the Freedom Riders were roughed up by a crowd of kind of young white male, white supremacists, kind of young toughs. But they were pleasantly surprised for the most part by the ease with which they went through the Upper South. They spent 2 days in Sumter, South Carolina, kind of recharging. A couple of the Freedom Riders had to leave temporarily, and they added four more student riders from Morris College in South Carolina, and went on to Atlanta, where they met with Dr. King, had dinner with him, and he was very complimentary about their effort, although in truth his aides and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had real mixed feelings, as most civil rights leaders did about the Freedom Ride. They thought it was perhaps too confrontational, too dangerous, too risky, Dr. King, the Freedom Riders hoped, would actually become a Freedom Rider himself, that at that dinner in Atlanta on May 13th, he would get on the bus with them, become a Freedom Rider. But not only did he not get on the bus, he took a couple of the leaders aside and said, look, I have my sources in Alabama say that the Klan is preparing quite a welcome, and it's going to be really dangerous, and someone may get killed. And if I were you, I'd think about stopping the ride in Atlanta. Of course, one of the principles of nonviolence, and Dr. King knew this, was that you can't let violence intimidate you. You have to accept the possibility that you may become a martyr. Hmm. And the unmerited suffering is one of the principles of nonviolent struggle. And so, of course, even though James Farmer, the head of Corps and the leader of the Freedom Ride, actually had to leave the ride in Atlanta because his father died that night just before they were about to leave. And he had to fly back to Washington to coordinate his father's funeral, and his mother was relieved, thinking that she may have saved her son's life, that her husband's death was a sad affair, but it may have actually been time to save her son. James Farmer left, and the other Freedom Riders were a bit unnerved by this, but they all went on. They got on those buses on Sunday morning, May 14th, which happened to be Mother's Day, and one bus Trailways, one was Greyhound, and they left an hour apart, but only one bus made it all the way to Birmingham. The Greyhound bus was attacked in Anniston by a Klan mob, and the bus was firebombed, and many of the Freedom Riders were very badly hurt. There was an attempt to burn them to death to block a Molotov cocktail was thrown through the bus, and the upholstery ignited, and it's a miracle that no one died. The other bus made it to Birmingham, but Bull Connor, the Commissioner of Public Safety in Birmingham, the infamous and a white supremacist who would gain even more fame as a leader of the so-called Southern way of life in those days, in 1963 with the cattle prods and fire hoses and attack dogs, he had conspired with the Klan to give the Klan essentially 15 to 20 minutes to beat the Freedom Riders within an inch of their life. He didn't really want them to kill him, but he wanted to make sure that they would never come back to Alabama again. And so both groups of Freedom Riders were severely injured, and by the end of the day on May 14th.
And the only reason that one group was allowed out of the burning bus is that the Klansmen who were trying to keep them inside thought the whole thing might explode and they needed to get away from where
they were. That's exactly right. The fuel tank blew up, and they drew back, and that gave them enough time to get off the bus. But, of course, once they got off the bus, the Klan attacked them, and Hank Thomas, who was the first off the bus, who was a strapping a former football star, was hit in the head with a baseball bat and received a concussion. Fortunately, there was one young woman, a 12-year-old girl, Janie Forsyth. All this took place in front of the Forsyth and Son grocery store, this little poor white community about 6 miles out of Anniston. Her father was actually, I'm not sure he was actually a member of the Klan, but he was certainly friendly with them and knew that they were planning this welcome and even told his daughter this when she saw the smoke inhalation and the Freedom Riders gasping for breath and on the ground and screaming for water. And it was just a horrible scene. She got a big bucket of water and went through the crowd, bravely through the crowd, and ministered to the Freedom Riders. They later had a Klan trial about whether she should be driven out of town and disciplined.
A 12-year-old. It's amazing.
An amazing, amazingly courageous thing. And she's become kind of the mascot of the Freedom Rider alumni. She's a really extraordinary woman. And she's featured in the American Experience film.
Ray, was the concern about, I mean, obviously Dr. King and other people were very concerned about the safety of the riders, clearly. Were they also concerned that given the level of violence they were likely to experience, it would be difficult to remain nonviolent and pacifist in their attempts to desegregate interstate travel?
Actually, I don't think so. I think they knew that the core riders were very well trained and disciplined and they would die first.
Mm-hmm.
And amazingly, they were ultimately in the spring and summer of 1961, 436 freedom rides. There were freedom riders on more than 60 freedom rides, and there's not a single incident of the nonviolence discipline breaking down. Not one even moment when they were in a position where they would strike back. It was really quite extraordinary. What they were worried about, I think, was more that freedom riders would be certainly be arrested. And there would be a tremendous drain on the resources of the movement in terms of bail money and arraignment costs and court costs, and that a lot of the leadership of the movement would end up in jail, and it would just drain the movement's power, which was very limited at that point. And the court didn't have very much money, and even the NAACP Legal Defense Fund was strapped, and so that they thought the whole thing would backfire, and of course so they. It was not a very popular move among the leaders of the movement initially. They thought it was sort of a grandstanding that some people thought that Jim Farmer was trying to elevate his visibility and that it was too risky and that very in all likelihood people would get killed and it would actually set the movement back. It wouldn't prove what they were trying to prove, that the South was ready for desegregation. On the contrary, it would prove that it wasn't ready for nonviolent direct action, and it would actually slow down the movement, which, of course, had already happened. With the exception of the sit-ins in 1960, school desegregation had slowed down, and there really wasn't any momentum, and they were afraid it would get even worse with the Freedom Rides. So it was it's only as the Freedom Rides developed and the courage and discipline of the riders became really the stuff of legend, that the violent reaction was so in Anniston and Birmingham and later in Montgomery when mobs attacked the Freedom Riders that the movement had to solidify and everyone had to rally to the cause and say we didn't think the Freedom Riders were a good idea, but we're all Freedom Riders now. And of course after the Freedom Riders, the second wave of Freedom Riders, the original riders that never make it past Birmingham, they have to give up their ride and they fly to New Orleans. and much to the relief of the Kennedy administration, who John Kennedy is about to go off to Vienna for his first summit meeting with Nikita Khrushchev, and the last thing in the world he wants are all these headlines showing that people are being nearly murdered in the Deep South just for trying to sit on the front seat of a bus. It makes our notion that we are the purveyors of freedom in the world, it makes a mockery of it. We came off as hypocrites, and so it was terrible publicity and notoriety for the United States. So the Kennedy administration is relieved when they make it to out of Alabama and to New Orleans by air, and they think it's over. The Freedom Ride experiment was sort of a qualified failure, and they're hoping that they'll take the struggle back into the courtrooms and not try this kind of confrontational technique. But of course, what happens is that a group of kids from Nashville, the Nashville movement was the most organized and progressive and sort of together local movement in the United States, and they had all had nonviolent workshops with Reverend James Lawson, who was a kind of a legendary figure in the world of nonviolence, who was a young black minister he was studying for his theology degree at Vanderbilt and was expelled because he was one of the leaders of the sit-ins in Nashville in 1960. In recent years, he's come back as a distinguished professor at Vanderbilt, so it was kind of a wonderful a closing of the circle. But in 1960, he was considered to be a dangerous radical by people, defenders of the status quo. But anyway, the Nashville kids, the Nashville movement, almost immediately after the bus was bombed in Anniston and the mobs gathered in Birmingham, they were on the buses coming south from Nashville, 21 new riders. And, of course, their courage and commitment led to many more freedom rides. And so they ultimately, there are more than 400 freedom riders, and they fill the jails of Mississippi, all going into Jackson and ultimately to Parchman Prison, where more than 300 of them serve 30 days or more. And of course, it was an attempt to intimidate them, to tell them that, you know, we're going to make you do hard time for this. This is not a summer lark. We're going to put you in the most dangerous prison in America. And of course, historically, that kind of intimidation had its effect, but it backfired with Freedom Riders. I mean, they had such extraordinary commitment to nonviolence that they turned Parchman Prison into a sort of a university of nonviolence. It became a national movement, and all of a sudden, the kids next door were becoming Freedom Riders. You know, Nelson Rockefeller's son-in-law and professors from Berkeley and rabbis and ministers and union leaders and teachers and just working class people and an exchange student from Indonesia and a blind white woman, 44-year-old blind white woman, Norma Wagner from Rochester, heard about this and decided to become a Freedom Rider, even though they wouldn't arrest her because they knew it was bad publicity to arrest a blind woman. But you get the sense that the white supremacists in Jackson and elsewhere just really didn't know what they were up against, and they were up against this incredible, rising movement of that the time had come to break the mystique of Jim Crow
and
create a national movement.
It got harder and harder for white supremacists in the South to argue that this was just Northern agitators coming in and trying to upset, you know, people that they had argued all along were perfectly happy with the way things were, because some of these people were, in fact, from the South.
That's right. Almost half of the Freedom Riders were from the South, and roughly half were black. A quarter were women. Many were deeply religious. Some were secular, certainly. There were Christians, Jews, atheists, everything in between. It was a kind of a cross-section of the United States. There was an attempt by the Deep South press, particularly Mississippi, to characterize them as communist dupes, that the decision to create the Freedom Ride, at first they said it was the Kennedy brothers, that this was their conspiracy. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. The Kennedys were as upset as anybody else initially about the Freedom Rides because it diverted attention from what they thought they were supposed to be doing. They considered it to really be a nuisance. But then the notion shifted that the Freedom Rides were actually conceived in Havana by Fidel Castro or in the Kremlin in the Soviet Union, that this was a part of the worldwide communist conspiracy. And I think some people in the Deep South actually believed that. But as time went on, it became increasingly difficult to sustain that kind of notion that when these college kids from all over the United States and others as well, housewives, people just who were had a sense of human decency, who were not willing to pass the responsibility off to the next generation or to anyone else, that they were going to go into the South, and of course there was an attempt to delegitimize it by saying that they were outside agitators, but as time passed in the summer of 1961, there were many local blacks from Mississippi who became freedom riders, and Southern whites started joining it, many of whom came from a religious perspective and who had been waiting for an opportunity to break out of the kind of confining structure of Jim Crow. So it's an amazing moment, really, of perhaps not unlike what we saw in the streets of Cairo recently.
What happened when Robert Kennedy called the governor of Alabama?
Well, there were several calls. Perhaps the most famous call was not from Robert Kennedy, but from John Kennedy. John Patterson, who had been a close political ally, and in fact the first Southern governor to endorse John Kennedy in 1960, had been his sort of unofficial Southern campaign manager and had helped to poll a large vote for Kennedy in the 1960 election in Alabama. He wouldn't take his call. He told the operator to tell the White House operator that he was out fishing in the Gulf of Mexico. In the film, he admits that he lied, as he says, "I just lied." And of course, this is when officials of the Kennedy administration and the Justice Department and elsewhere began to realize that this was really a serious situation. That when you had people like Bull Connor in Birmingham and Klansmen running wild, that who knew what might happen? And at one point, Bull Connor sort of almost kidnapped the Freedom Riders out of jail and drove them up to the border of Tennessee and left them off in the middle of the night. They thought maybe for a Klan ambush. And John Siegenthaler, who was
Let me
Kennedy.
Have you stop there, Ray. We're going to take a quick break. Raymond Arsenault is my guest. His book is called Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is professor of Southern history at the University of South Florida at St. Petersburg, Raymond Arsenault. His book is called Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. The book has been adapted into an American Experience documentary that will air on KERA Channel 13 television on May 16th. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Right, you were talking about Bull Connor sort of taking a group of people who had been in jail, including John Siegenthaler, who I guess was a representative of President Kennedy.
Yes. What I was talking about is after the second wave of Freedom Riders from Nashville were arrested in Birmingham, and of course, as was their tradition, they were singing nonstop freedom songs in the jail. Finally, Bull Connor just couldn't take the freedom songs any longer, so he rounded them up and put them in a couple of police cars and put their baggage in a hearse and drove them up to the Tennessee border and let them off. And of course they were afraid that this was going to be an ambush. And one of the riders, Catherine Burks Brooks, who was from Birmingham, was sitting in the front seat with him, with Bull Connor, as he's speeding off back to Birmingham. She said, "We'll see you back in Birmingham by high noon." And she didn't make it back by noon, but they made it back about 3 o'clock. And I would have loved to have seen Bull Connor's face when he looked across at the bus station and saw the people he'd just let out hours before on the border. an amazing group of human beings who would always find a way to fight for social justice.
The singing is a really interesting element of this because, you know, in most accounts of the Freedom Riders, when you hear about them being jailed, you hear about them singing. And obviously they were trying to get their message out, but I have to imagine it was a source of sort of fortitude for them.
It was, but it was also a means of communicating. I was talking to one of the Freedom Riders, Bernard Lafayette, the other day, and who was making this point that, you know, they were in cells with two people, and they couldn't see each other, and the women were separated from the men, and the whites were separated from the blacks in most cases, and so they would use the Freedom songs as a way of communicating, of saying, you know, we're all right, we're going to make it, and so it built morale, but it also communicated all sorts of things through the Freedom Rides, through Freedom Songs, excuse me.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones and speak with Trace in Fort Worth. Hi, Trace.
Hi there. Mary Anders Show here. I'm curious about the guys today that call themselves Freedom Riders that help bury soldiers and keep the crowds away. Is there any relationship in between the two? And I'll hang up and listen over the radio. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I'm not sure I know exactly the group that you're talking about, but I'm virtually certain that there's no connection whatsoever. Of course, the notion of a Freedom Rider, it's not something that you can copyright or patent, or you can't keep other people from using the term. And there have been in the last few years any number of groups who've tried to appropriate the label. Sometimes when their goals and objectives were diametrically opposed to the original Freedom Riders. In fact, if you go on the web and put in Freedom Rider, if you Google it, the first thing that comes up are motorcycle groups. So, and Freedom Rider became a generalized term in the 1960s. Much of the consternation, I think, of some of the authentic Freedom Riders, who they knew who got on those buses and who didn't, and who was a Freedom Rider and who wasn't, and so You know, they had a very special place to hold in the movement, and so they like to make sure that the term is used appropriately, but they obviously can't guarantee that.
This is really a very 21st century way of looking at it, but in terms of branding, I mean, the name Freedom Riders really was just incredibly brilliant.
Yeah, it actually comes from, there were two field secretaries, Gordon Carey and a young black field secretary from South Carolina, who were on their way to New York to the Corps office, and they got caught in the blizzard, actually the same blizzard that you see some of it during John Kennedy's inauguration when it was so cold. They got stranded at a rest stop on the floor of they spent the night on the floor of a Howard Johnson restaurant, and one of them, Gordon Carey, had a biography of Gandhi by Louis Fisher that he was reading, and they started talking about Gandhi all through the night, and they got the notion that they should have something equivalent to Gandhi's March to the Sea, and why don't we have our sort of ride to the sea, and we'll ride from Washington to New Orleans, and we can't call it a journey of reconciliation. Let's call it a freedom ride. And that's where the whole thing began.
What sort of leadership positions did the Freedom Riders go on to take in the remainder of the civil rights movement?
They became the equivalent of the shock troops of the movement. They were everywhere. In the voting rights campaigns in Birmingham in 1963, at Freedom Summer in 1964, John Lewis, of course, speaking in the March on Washington in August of 1963, took leading roles in the Selma to Montgomery March in 1965. They got involved, many of them, in the anti-war movement. This was a lifetime commitment for most of them, and they found any number of ways of fighting for social justice. I have an appendix in my book that tracks as many of them as I could find in terms of what their later careers were, and it's just anything you can think of they did. They were involved in any number of causes in education, in social welfare, as writers, as activists, as I get calls all the time from various media outlets about them, their activities. Even now, most of them are in their 70s, and there were a couple of women who were arrested relatively recently in Canada for being part of the Raging Grannies anti-war movement. And the Canadian Broadcasting Company called me and said, "Do you know these women?" And I said, "Well, yes, I do." I'm not surprised at all. I mean, they're troublemakers in the best sense of the term. Mm-hmm. I mean, they when other people are willing to look the other way, they can be unreasonable in the context of a time, but unreasonable in a creative way. They're always looking for some way to search for what they call the beloved community, and they're very much aware that we haven't reached that yet, and that the legacy of the Freedom Rides is sort of bittersweet, that they were able to leverage politically the Kennedy administration to get them to come around to put pressure on the Interstate Commerce Commission in September of 1961 to render a sweeping desegregation order that desegregated the buses. And I mean, the Kennedys responded to the pressure, and they moved, of course, further along the road to actively supporting the civil rights movement. And by 1963, the Kennedy administration was advancing a major civil rights bill, which of course didn't come to fruition until the Lyndon Johnson years after President Kennedy's assassination. But their ultimate goal, what they would have preferred to do, was to change the hearts and minds of Americans, to inculcate nonviolence, not just as a tactic or a strategy, but as a way of life.
Why did the Interstate Commerce Commission's ruling have more palpable impact than the ruling of the Supreme Court in 1946?
Excuse me, I didn't get the question.
The Interstate Commerce Commission essentially outlawing segregation.
Yes. Well, the ICC was really the only agency that had the power under federal law to take down the white-only and the colored-only signs that had been in the terminals and bus stations for generations. Robert Kennedy, as Attorney General, didn't have the direct power to do that. He asked them to issue the desegregation order. But the ICC was a notoriously slow-moving and conservative agency. And it took several months for them to move, I think, and there was all kinds of pressure put on them behind the scenes to render this decision, and they ultimately did give Kennedy the sweeping desegregation order that he had asked for. In the meantime, of course, he wanted the Freedom Rides to stop. He said, "Now that I've gone to the ICC, there's no reason to have any more Freedom Rides." Of course, the Freedom Riders had a very different view. They said, "We're not going to stop. You've got to show us. You can't just." Tell us that you're going to do this at some point." So they kept the pressure on, and much to the consternation of Robert Kennedy and I think of many Americans. There was the public opinion show that a large majority of Americans, even in parts of the Upper South, had positive feelings toward the goals of the Freedom Rides, of that people should have the right to sit anywhere they want on a bus or to anywhere they want in a bus terminal or rail terminal, but they didn't approve of the tactics, the disruption of the civic order sort of cut against the grain, and it was a tactic that many Americans rejected, and it, and again I think the Freedom Rides are become a template, kind of a model for the grassroots direct action politics that ordinary citizens began to adopt in the 1960s, and it really is one of the, if you're looking for reasons why the 50s had such a different feel and tone, the so-called silent generation of the 1950s being replaced by the tumultuous 1960s with the anti-war movement and the women's movement and gay and lesbian struggles and the environmental movement and any numbers of the parts of the so-called rights revolution that comes to change American society in the coming decades. The Freedom Rides is a very good place to start, and sort of the event that expands the realm of the possible in American democracy.
When you started to research this in earnest and talk to individuals, was it one of those things where everyone you spoke to said, "Oh, you ought to call these other three people"? And did it sort of work that way for you?
It did. I actually did a lot of my interviewing at Freedom Rider reunions beginning in 2001, and it was a revelatory experience. It didn't take me very long to realize that this was an extraordinary story, and I wasn't sure that any historian could do full justice to it, that it was going to be the work of my life if I could somehow track down these Freedom Riders and to tell their story in a comprehensive and authoritative way. And I felt an enormous sense of responsibility and a challenge. And they're an amazing group of human beings, I have to say. Historians, we like to keep our sense of detachment and a certain level of objectivity, and it complicates things when your historical actors are still alive, mm-hmm. They're looking over your shoulder. And I didn't want to turn them into sort of cartoon characters. I wanted them to represent them as flesh and blood human beings who had all the complications and problems that other people have. But I think, you know, my sense is that these were ordinary people who did extraordinary things. But after spending the last 12 years dealing with this subject, I have to say these are in some senses not ordinary people. That these 436 people somehow reached down for the kind of inner physical and moral courage to do something that I think most of us probably couldn't imagine ourselves doing. In some of the screenings of the film, we've given out T-shirts with a question on the front of the T-shirt: could you get on the bus?
Hmm.
It's one of those questions that puts a lump in your throat. I mean, what kind of 19 or 20-year-old is willing to write out their last will and testament and to get on a bus to fight for a principle for freedom and social justice, knowing that they may very well be killed or that this will negatively affect their life? The Freedom Riders made enormous sacrifices for the rest of us, and some of them never got their degrees, were pushed into careers that they didn't expect. But I think the ones that I've talked to, I haven't met a single one who said it wasn't worth it, that this was something that they really feel like they had a part in altering the course of American history, changing the nature of American democracy.
Raymond Arsenault is John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida at St. Petersburg. His book is called Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. The American Experience documentary based on the book airs on KERA Channel 13 television on May 16th. Ray, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.